an office today where Wi-Fi will be better. Magyanati Mirandasya Gyanam Jana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Jana Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaham Nama Shrishtam Manumapi Satchiputram Matra Sarupam Rupam Tasyagrajamuru Purim Maturim Goshtavatim Radhakundam Girivaram Maho Radhikamadhavasam Praptu Yasya Pratitagripaya Shri Gurum Tam Natasmi Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhyaivacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhya Namo Namaha Nikhilashrutimoliratnamaladiti Nirajitapadapankajanta Ajimuktakulairupashyamanam Paritashtvamharinamsamshrayami Anarpitacharimchiratkarunayavatiranakaloh Samarpaitum natochvalarasam Sabhaktisriyam Hari Purata Sundara Dyuti Kadamba Sandipita Sadahridaye Kandaresh Puratova Sachinandana Janulambita Bujo Kanakapadato Sankirtanai Kapitaro Vande Jagat Priyakaro Karunavataru Ladini Shakti Swarupaya Gauranga Suhridayacha Bhakta Shakti Pradanaya Gadadharanamastute He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dinabandho Jagatpate Gupesha Gupika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastute Radhe Vrindavanadishi Karunamritavahine Kripaya Nijapadabjadasyanmahim Pradiyatam Bhaktya Bihinayaparadhalakshay Kshiptashtakamaditarangamadhyay Kripamaitvam Sharanam Prapanam Vrinde Namaste Charanaravindam Vrinde Namaste Charanaravindam Shri Sachinandan Gaur Hari ki jai, Shri Hari Nam Prabhu ki jai, Shri Radha Kund ki jai, Chama Kund ki jai, Vrindavan Dham ki jai, Navadvip Dham ki jai, Samaved Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Hari Bol. Pranam to all of you. Welcome to our weekly satsang, Encounters with the Truth, or as this beautiful book by Srila Siddhartha Maharshi called Encounters with Divinity, Encounters with the Sacred, however we may like to call it, but it is an encounter, right? It is like a showing up, it is like a allowing ourselves to be seen. The truth is always showing up. But we have to show up. The other day we were talking with a friend here. The ethic or the spirit behind what's sometimes called Surya Namaskar in the yoga tradition. But beyond the yoga tradition, the daily showing up to the father figure in the form of the sun. No? The sun constitutes the father archetype. No? So we were talking how if our father figure, whether biological father, spiritual father, for whatever reason we felt, they didn't show up or they didn't show up enough. Still, the archetype of the father figure, the son, is showing up every day. The point is, do we show up or not? And that's the whole ethic behind this idea of Brahma Muhurta, or those few first moments of the day of showing up when the sun is rising, right? Showing up with the father figure. And at that time, the scriptures say Surya becomes Sakshat Narayan, interestingly, becomes directly God, no? Interestingly enough, like the dispeller of darkness, the bringer of light, nourishment, warmth, and In one sense, the archetype of the father figure showing up and inviting us to show up. So, in the same way, the truth, divinity, the sacred is always showing up. It's omnipresent, it's omni shower up. But sadhana bhakti basically is we have to show up. We are invited to show up, no? And to realize that, the sweet absolute was showing up from time without beginning. And waiting for our fulfillment of the rendezvous, of the date, of the appointment. So here we are. Satsang basically is that, is showing up on a weekly basis, but that weekly showing up is not a thing to, oh, let's see if Maharaj sees my face and checks the, I'm checking the boxes, I'm legal. But showing up for each other, showing up for ourselves, showing up as a commitment to the truth, as the willingness to expose ourselves to what will happen when we show up in a circle of honest seekers. So many things can happen that will never happen just by ourselves. No? The chemistry, the alchemy of a combined village creates in itself a unique atmosphere, unique environment. And even if it's in Zoom, even if it's online, it's still. Still, something is created that cannot be created otherwise. So, we are very grateful and blessed to have the chance of being here together, especially myself. Very happy to be with all of you, still in Radhakund. Tomorrow, I have my last full day here before transitioning into another expression of the Dhamma in the form of Sri Navadvip. And having had the blessings of receiving a shower of affection from most of you a few days ago on Gopashtami for my lunar birthday as well. Thank you so much again. And yes, having also great fortune of meeting very special souls, elders, sadhus, friends, brothers, sisters these days as well. In a few days, I hope I may share a few pictures and videos of the recent adventures on this side of the Dham, but very nourished. And looking for further nourishment in the company of each one of you. So, without further ado, I'm seeing many hands raised. So, I hope I can honor each one of them in time properly. So, we'll begin with the first one, which is coming from Gayatri. So, please, Gayatri, invite to unmute yourself and more than welcome.
Pranams, Maharaj, happy birthday again. I hope your celebration continues right as you continue your voyage in India.
Till my solar birthday on November 15th.
Exactly.
That's my excuse to have two cakes per year, basically.
I love that. We all need that excuse. I need to figure out where my lunar birthday, maybe all of us as well too do. It's so good to see you all. Just a question that's more of a Q&E, I suppose, and just interested in your reflections on this past week, just reflecting on this process that we go through in Bhakti Yoga, and what often develops for a lot of us is a very rich inner world or inner experience, as it were. That sometimes is or isn't congruent with the outer experience of our lives as well too. So kind of one foot in both worlds, looking for ways to connect the two. Just curious about your own journey and others, just reflections on how to continue to make those two congruent, how to continue make both ends rich in this experience as well too. Does that make sense?
It does. Thank you. Yeah. First, I will say it's an ongoing process, right? There are always newer layers to integrate. It's not just this thing over here, this thing over here. I have only two things to put together and game over. But there are endless layers of complexity to be harmonized, accommodated, integrated forever. Of course, it may begin with a more how to say, raw black and white, this spiritual life, material life, as sometimes we use those terms, until we gradually start to see, actually, ideally, I shouldn't see this, I shouldn't create, I don't, hopefully, I don't feel the need to create this division between so-called material life and spiritual life, but I can, at least in theory, have a glimpse that both can be part of one same project. And of course, when even we get a glimpse of that and we even express ourselves in those terms, still there is so much to be integrated. Even if you get to that point of realizing on some level, okay, it's all spiritual life. It's all part of the same journey. But still there are so many elements, so many currents, so many circumstances that beg for proper integration. Like for example, today I was reflecting a little bit on that, interestingly, being here in Radhakund, which is a very particular place. Most of you maybe do not know it, but some of you. India is a particular place, as is United States, as is Argentina, as is every place, right? We tend to think the other places are particular and my place is normal, but the other person is thinking exactly the other way around. So each place has its own cultural sensibilities, its own way of doing things, its own way of thinking, of expressing emotions, of speaking, of doing everything. And how to integrate all that. Again, most of us are Western-born Gaudiya Vaishnavas, most, not all. And there may be some culture and sensibilities that we may not relate fully with the Indian subcontinent, and that's not necessarily something bad or wrong. Because sometimes we may become, yeah, fanatical in terms of, okay, everything has to be super Indian now. How I talk and dress, I move my hands, I'm blink even. I don't know how it's an Indian blinking, but anyhow, we can get to that point. And we may lose the point at all, right? So all that needs to be integrated. That's my point, right? Okay, I'm here in this beautiful place. I love Radhakund. I love the local atmosphere. I love the environment. I love many things. And there are some other elements I may not necessarily say not love, but I may resonate when expressed in a different way that I cannot expect a local Radhakundavasi to express it in that way, and that's okay. So again, all this needs to also be integrated, right? So I'm not thinking, oh, this is worse, this is best, this is wrong, this is better, good, bad. Again, this dualistic framing. But so that's part of the journey as well. So all this to say that I personally, in my personal experience, I see the whole journey, the whole spiritual project from day one till eternity in different degrees, in different ways, with different capacities and levels of seeing, but as a constant effort to integrate and accommodate newer levels of complexity, newer dimensions of love, as I was saying the other day. On my birthday, right? I shared a short reflection online that it was kind of suddenly, it was like a sudden flooding of greetings, birthday wishes, and affection, and appreciation, and gratitude. And it was like a condensed dose of that. So, and I'm not complaining, of course, about that. But the point is, all that took me to say, okay, my heart was not accustomed to on a daily basis to receive such a flooding. So by force of circumstance, I need to accommodate that. I don't want to reject that. I don't want to be indifferent to that. I want to cherry pick that, whatever fits in my vessel, but I want to expand the vessel of my heart, the container, so I can contain all that. So that's a form of adaptation, adjustment, integration, harmonizing, accommodation, whatever word works best. And that will happen in eternity, because in eternity love keeps growing, and as we say the other day, love always outgrows its vessels. Love, God's heart keeps getting bigger. Let's put it that way. Love keeps getting bigger, and for us to coexist with that reality, we need to keep getting bigger. That there's no other way. We need to develop more and more capacity to hosting capacity, for the divine. So. And it may all begin wherever we are, in whatever small way, quote unquote small, we may be in capacity of doing now. And how to say, reduce the duality we may still have in terms of material life, spiritual life, the spiritual reality, and the other reality, Our tradition and every mystical tradition clearly says over and over again, there's only one reality. Everything is contained within that one reality, non-dual reality. There are not two realities. The very fact that we may think there are two is a symptom of illusion. And not to feel bad about it in extreme ways, but just to have the healthy reminder that ultimately, there's only one family, there's only one center, there's only one reality. And that center is everywhere. As Julius Caesar Marsh will quote a Western theologian, the center is everywhere and their circumference is nowhere. Because if the center is everywhere, there's no circumference because the center is omnipresent. So there's only one reality. Easier said than done. And that's why sadhana, bhajan, devotional spiritual practice and absorption and inner life and prayer and practice, it's all about begging for the grace and opening to that current to spend some quality time to enter that space, to get a glimpse of reality, to get a glimpse of how things actually operate. So whenever we quote unquote go back to quote unquote normal life, many quote unquotes here, we can still carry the impressions of those deep moments that will gradually affect more and more the way we see everything else, the quote unquote ordinary, till we reach the point where the whole thing becomes so blurred in the good sense of the term that there is no longer need to, oh, I'm going from this to this. I'm leaving my spiritual moment to enter into the mundane chapter. Because ultimately, there is no mundane chapter, there's no ordinariness. It's just that we may not be able to carry the momentum of our short epiphanies or short moments of practice, right? And it's okay. It's part of the practice. Those who have not yet reached the stage called nishta or stability means basically you lose that momentum. You lose certain, it's not you lose completely, but you lose the awareness of that. You lose the day-to-day experience that though you have experienced things that are so real that you cannot never forget that. But in the day-to-day, in certain dynamics, we may not be able to keep the experience with us. So it's part of the journey. Before you reach nista, that is meant to happen. That's a symptom of the journey before reaching nista, which still confirms you are on the path. Nista somehow means fixity, stability means you somehow have expanded the inner vessel to the point that you can honor and keep these momentums. Gradually, they just get bigger and bigger. No? There are different ways to speak about all these stages of the journey, but it will be like reaching the top, walking uphill to the top of the mountain, and the top of the mountain will be kind of nishta. And then the remaining stages after nishta are going downhill. No? You don't need to keep the momentum. You are going downhill. You are gaining momentum the more you advance. Nishta, Ruchi, Shakti, Bhava, Prem, and all the sub-stages of Prem. But first, it's a little bit uphill. And there has to be a conscious effort, conscious discipline, sacrifice. But based on previous experiences that have shown us, this is for real. So even when I'm not feeling it, even when I feel I've lost it, I know it's real. I know it's not entirely lost. I need to make some special effort to be present to what is always there. So I don't know if that helps to articulate a little bit.
It does so much. I forget, the dualism, and leaning into it and coming off of it as well too. Very good perspective. Really appreciate that. Thank
Yeah.
you.
Yeah, and it's no easy answer. And of course, whenever we feel I'm losing it and this is ordinary, this is mundane, now I'm in my material life again, especially when we hear those voices inside of us, that means you are being ex especially invited at that precise moment to put all your spiritual tools to work. So you stop seeing all that as mundane, ordinary, material, blah, blah, blah. Now, the very fact that that voice is coming is an invitation to, in a healthy way, challenge that voice and bring the knowledge, the tools, your previous experience to reframe, change your angle of vision, whatever situation you may be in, and make that inner exercise of gaining a new perspective and regaining a new per and a constant again readjustment, accommodation, harmonizing. Till again we find a proper perspective. And again, many times we need guides. We need people that can point to us, hey, look there. And like, oh, I have forgotten that was there. You just need someone to say, look there. And you're like, how did I never thought to look in that direction? It was always there. But sometimes we just need someone who is like, Śrīla Mahārāja gives this example that Guru Parampara or the different guardian angels that bless our path are like a telescope, right? So telescope and telescope and a telescope, there are many glasses, lenses in between the last one and your eye, right? So you may think, oh, so many things are getting in the way of me and what I want to see. So I won't use the telescope. I just look it through my own eye directly. Well, you won't see it. So the telescope is facilitating the seeing. This, even if many things are in the way, but they're in the way in a way that is facilitating and amplifying what you need and want to see. So they are not getting in the way, they're just facilitators. But you need to get the telescope, start with the telescope from the right glass, the small one, and it gets bigger and bigger. If you get in the other way, you'll get the headache of your life. So you also start small, approach the principle of divine revelation with humility, in other words, right? Okay, thank you. Some thoughts. It's always good to talk about these things. Yeah. Okay, let's go to the next question. We may not have time. We will go to some breakout rooms, but we may have many hands raised, so we will skip a few. So, with your permission, Gayatri, we are skipping breakthrough rooms here, trusting you all have enough breakthrough, hopefully, now, and we'll move to John's sharing today.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Swami.
Good morning.
Actually, I would be happy to defer my question to offer a chance for us to go into a breakthrough room because I felt like that question and response had so much depth and nuance that maybe we could individually share some reflections on it instead of me asking any question.
And you are willing to renounce you going to a breakthrough rooms in response to whatever you have to share then.
Absolutely.
Okay. Kijai to that detachment and then passing your seatbelt. And you will be all invited for those who are joining first time. We have these breakthrough rooms. We call it their breakthrough, not breakout rooms, but we will share in groups of three approx for a few minutes. Any reflections, any churning, further churning that we can do collectively, again, beyond what we can do individually. And enrich each other, bless each other, enlighten each other, like Krishna says in the Gita 10:9. My devotees bless and enlighten each other, nourish each other by sharing openly, sincerely. Hopefully, again, all together we can create a safe vessel, safe space, and continue nourishing our connection. So Bhakti Rasa will invite you now and we'll see each other in a few minutes. Welcome back. I hope that John's decision was a wise one. I trust, and I can see that from your smiling faces, that you had a nice, nourishing space, sacred space. Great, beautiful.
Amazing, amazing.
Amazing, amazing grace that flows in the breakthrough rooms. Beautiful. Thank you.
Aishwaryavat.
Okay, wonderful, 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 amazing, amazing, amazing. So John has generously relinquished and released his own question for the sake of the sharing. Thank you for that sacrifice for the cause. And then, therefore, we will turn to Sam and Anurag. So I don't know who of the two have something to say, but I suspect for some particular reason it's Sam.
Did you know? I wanted to ask my question again about what Prabhupada says concerning sex life and how it can you that sex life can be found in the personality in Krishna. But also, he talks about sex life in relationship to lust as well. Because I remember I asked it last time, but the connection was a bit spotty. So I've managed to sort of consolidate my inquiry into how should we really view sex life? What should be the healthiest perspective on sex life? You know, it's in terms of seeing it as an expression between two people that love each other, but then also at the same time, can it also be, because it's sometimes it's talked about as an impediment to spiritual life. So in what context can it be healthy, and also what context can it also serve as something that's becoming unhealthy, you know, in terms of how the person's engaging with it?
Yeah, thank you, Sam, for bringing the question again. And one more time, my apologies for having been kidnapped last week at the moment where I was trying to say something. Somehow my connection went off, and that's why I'm where I am now, in a different place that I have Wi-Fi, so I have secure connection. So of course I do not even recall where did I get when the connection went off, and I don't have any script, so we'll share some thoughts. It's an important question. A caveat is I'm not the most experienced person to talk about sex life, to be honest, at least from certain expression and dimension of it. This is sannyasi and so basically lifelong monastic almost. So, but I think there I can say a few things from my own perspective. I can say a few things from the cases I've bear witness to. Trying to accompany them on their journey, and from what scripture say and tradition says about it, all of that is equally valuable, right? So of course, let's begin with the basic idea that our tradition is not about rejecting anything, and we are, in a healthy way, obsessed with finding the virtuous, constructive, positive expression of anything and everything. Now we have that intrinsic hope that if something exists, it exists for a purpose, and we just need to discover that purpose and embrace that purpose, whatever that may be. Of course, we are talking about sex life, but it goes beyond that particular theme. So everything exists for a particular reason. Including sex life. And the ideal purpose is to be discovered. And when that's not the case, of course, things turn dark. Things turn how to say, blind. Things turned insensitive. Things end up promoting or conveying suffering and anxiety and so many things. But that's not the thing itself, but it's our misconception about the thing, right? As Srila Siddhartha Maharaj once will say, he say, all our problems only exist due to our lack of proper conception. I love that line. Try to think about all your problems, or all you label as problem, and he will say that exists because of your lack of proper conception. Another word for proper conception will be sambandha, right? So how to properly conceive the concept? We talked about that in radical personalism. There's a whole section with that title, learning to conceive the concept, learning to embrace proper conception. In this case, sex life. So, and sometimes there are these words, right? Sex life on one side, then you have a word like lust, a word like desire, a word in Sanskrit like kama. And sometimes we tend to put all of them together in the same box, and we do a huge disservice to reality by doing so. Because sex life is not something intrinsically bad. It's very clear a part of the natural order of things, not only in this created world, let's say, but even in the Leela, as we said, it constitutes the highest expression of communion between the divine female and the divine male. As shocking as it may sound, and sorry to say it, you may cover your ears if you want, but God has sex life. How you feel about it? Hopefully you don't feel embarrassed or ashamed or like cringy about it. Because that's very clear, at least from our tradition. Of course, in other traditions, they may not speak about that so openly, at least, and so much in detail. But our tradition is very clear about it. And it's very interesting because our tradition is very clear about it. And our tradition also has stigmatized sex life very much. So that's very paradoxical, right? Because on one side, you have this ideal, detailed depiction of loving communion of Radha and Krishna in the form of sex life, in the form of consummation, sambhog, union. And of course, another thing is to speak about in utter detail, and our teachers will say there's a prevention to that in the sense that if we are not properly connected with sex life in a healthy way, we may misconstrue and misread all that, and we don't want to go there. We don't want to do that. So, one of the ways of properly understand God's sex life is not necessarily by becoming celibate and becoming a sannyasi or whatever, or a monk or a nun. I mean, that can happen, of course, if it's for the proper reasons. But also, it's another way of learning to relate to sex life or to sexual energy in a healthy way. And that's what I like to always say. Sexual energy is a more accurate expression for me than just sex life, that it becomes reduced to the biological act, which is part of the whole thing. But sexual energy has more to do with creative energy. So it expresses in the form of creativity, intimacy, connection, and it becomes a natural expression of love. So even if someone like me who is not engaged in the biological act per se, I have sexual energy and I need to do something with that. And not do something with that as something negative that I need to get away of, but something very positive and powerful that I need to know how to express. The Vedas, the very ancient Vedas will say, Kamastad Agre. Interestingly, Kamastad Agre. In the beginning, well, the Bible will say in the beginning was the word. Here the Rig Veda says in the beginning there was kamas. Kama. Kama means desire. Sometimes translated as lust, but lust, kama means desire. No? So again, desire is not bad. It's what we do with desire that it can make desire bad or not bad. In the sense, if it's a self-centered, isolated, fragmented desire based on a fragmented self-centered sense of self, then that becomes a problem. But the problem is not actually the desire. The problem is the self-alienation, self-isolation, dualistic thinking that fragments myself from everything else. That's the problem. When that's solved, desire is no problem. Actually, it's facilitator of so many things. So our tradition is pro-desire, pro-kama. Of course, kama can be related to sexuality, but not necessarily only to that. So, in principle, there is nothing bad with sexual union or with sexual practice. If we speak about the practice in itself, I'm not someone who will tell you sexual activity has to be reduced only to procreation. At the same time, I'm not someone who will say just have as much sex as you can and enjoy wildly and that's great. There's no absolute problem with that. No, I don't agree with that. Of course, you can do whatever you want with your life, but for me, there is an in-between place between those two poles, which is in a committed relationship, you can interact sexually with your partner as an expression, as a consequence, as a byproduct of the connection, intimacy, affection that you both experience with one another. It is possible for it to be such an expression. And as we talked many times, if we do that from the proper place, that's a very vulnerable situation. So for you to have a healthy sex life, you have to be very well trained in vulnerability. Because if not, you will be so terrified about being vulnerable in sex life that you will just weaponize sex life and end up using it as some the perfect thing to not be vulnerable. And then you end up being abusive, probably. You end up in a very abusive relationship experience through sex life. And by this, I'm not just talking about raping people. It's just even having sexual connection with your partner from a non-vulnerable place, from an escapist place. So it's an interaction of evasiveness and toxicity many times. Because again, in order to have sexual life, you need to be naked, and that in itself is vulnerable, right? You don't walk in the street just naked and allowing to be seen by everyone in your nakedness. That's pretty vulnerable, right? So you need to feel safe enough to show up naked. And I'm talking physically, but it goes beyond the physical. Now, do I show up to people in my nakedness? Again, if it's not physical, at least internally, many times we don't. So we need to be well trained in vulnerability. And again, as I always say, for us to be trained in vulnerability and for us to dare and to be vulnerable, first, we need to feel it is safe to be vulnerable. I am in a safe space, because if not, I will not be vulnerable. I should not be vulnerable. If I'm vulnerable in an environment where there is no safety, my vulnerability can is the open door for me to be trampled on and to be abused and to be neglected and dismissed and whatnot. So I'm saying all this because, again, sometimes we just think, okay, sexual act is the first thing. Unfortunately, many times that's the case, right? Okay, first comes sex, then comes the getting to know the person, then comes the relationship. And when in some cultures or traditions they have tried to make the other present the other order as ideal, there is a purpose to that. But of course, we need to explain the purpose and make sense of the purpose so it doesn't sound just like rigid dogma that are repressing me. But actually, it's a very clear, subtle thinking that is protecting me and is trying to invite me to actually experience what ultimately a sexual encounter can bestow in its ideal form. Again, in terms of connection, creativity, intimacy, vulnerability. And something also interesting that recently I heard from a teacher connected to Advaita Vedanta, but very interesting speaker, and he will say that the fact that many people, and this is mostly unconscious for most people, but the fact that most people pursue sexual life, and by the way, nowadays there is a, in terms of numbers, there's a great decay of people pursuing actual biological sexual life because everything is becoming more and more related to the technological realm, digital realm, less and less 3D relationships. So, and I don't go into the details of AI and all the facilities that it provides in that particular realm. But anyhow, my point is, he was saying, those who pursue it, ultimately, the climax of the encounter is such that both people forget about themselves. Even if it lasts for a moment, but you experience a moment of self-forgetfulness. And that's such a relief, right? Such a relief to forget about yourself for a moment. Not that in the sense that you are something bad, but self-forgetfulness has a positive side. Ultimately, when you study the love of the gopis for Krishna, the love of any true lover of the divine, it is to be described as Srila Siddhar Maharaj will make this hierarchy. He will say, at one level, there is self-sacrifice. I'm aware that I'm doing an effort, as we talked before, a sacrifice for the pleasure of God, whatever. But on top of that, there is self-forgetfulness in divine love. You are no longer thinking that you are doing a sacrifice. You are no longer thinking about you. You are so fascinated with the object of your love and affection that you just forgot yourself in a healthy way. Because you can also forget yourself in a toxic way. So that's why we have to be careful how to navigate all that whenever we are in our stage as sadhakas. And sometimes we may need to pay attention to ourselves considerably, so gradually in a healthy way we can learn to forget about ourselves. But out of wonder and fascination. So, but this is the point, right? In connection to sex life. This person said, even if it lasts for a few seconds, that experience of for a moment forgetting about myself is so relishable. So that gives us a glimpse of what it must be to live a life of self-forgetfulness in divine love. In divine love, right? Again, not self-forgetfulness, just. And again, for many of us, maybe like a faraway ideal, long-term goal to attain, it's fine. But let's not just take that out of the whole spectrum, right? And let's relate how day-to-day experiences, whether it is sexual life or anything, can give us hints and glimpses into eternity, into what must that be when amplified to its maximum. When I can give myself to other person in full vulnerability, intimacy, connection, and the result of that is self-forgetfulness in divine love for the pleasure of the other person. And again, the sexual interaction between two people may be, for many, a beginning of that of training our hearts, our exercise in order to make that a universal pattern. How to give my heart vulnerably in full intimacy, connection, and creativity to the entirety of creation with the sweet absolute in the center. I know it's a big ideal. We may need to begin somehow more local in a somehow more localized version of it. But from the local, we need to expand to the universal, from the local interest to the universal wave, as Jules Cidre will say. No, which wave are we riding? Which way are we surfing on? So these are some reflections in connection to sexuality, which is not necessarily an impediment to a spiritual life. Everything can be an impediment, including sexual life, but any other thing when it's not properly conceived. Even though things that seem the most holy and sacred can become an impediment if I embrace them improperly. Again, the name of Krishna, the most sacred of the sacred, can become an impediment if I start to chant the name of Krishna from a place of fear, calculation, just counting, not chanting, whatever. But that it's not that the name is an impediment, but my dysfunctional approach to the name is an impediment, right? So the same, sexuality is not in itself an impediment, but I can approach it from a place of, again, evasiveness, escapism, exploitation, self-centeredness, who knows, whatever. That's the actual impediment, no? So sometimes we end up naming the wrong problem, and that in itself becomes another problem. That's why I like to quote always Albert Einstein saying, if I will have 60 minutes to solve a problem, I will spend the first 55 trying to understand the problem, which is the actual problem. Then 5 minutes solving the problem. It won't take much after I actually know which is the problem, after I have the, get the proper diagnosis. Now, it may take more time to get the diagnosis than to prescribe the medicine, so to say. But if you misdiagnose the whole thing and you then prescribe who knows which medicine, problem upon problem upon problem. The problem began with the misdiagnosis. So it's proper, it's important that we get it right from the beginning. No? And we do not stigmatize or even demonize things that are not intrinsically bad. And we just get the right proper conception of things. And then we learn to relate to them accordingly, depending on our situation in life. Again, me as a monk, I need to do to relate to this particular topic, sexuality, sexual energy, from my own particular way, that is ends up being healthy for me. No? And each one of you have to find your own way. But it's never about avoiding, repressing, denying, rejecting, stigmatizing, labeling as ontologically an impediment. That's not solving the problem. That's creating a new one. So be careful of, in the name of solving the problem, just we are creating and perpetrating more and more problems. That can happen. So those are some thoughts. Of course, these are huge topics that deserve time and attention. But at least we are, trying to open the conversation and keep the door of the conversation open. I don't know if that helps.
That does incredibly helpful and incredibly insightful. Thank you, Maharaj. Thank you very much. And healing, very healing. Thank
Okay.
you.
No, thank you. My pleasure. And we have a section, a whole section. I thought the topic is so important that we had a whole section in radical personalism in the second part, in the middle part of the book, where we talk about different radicals. And at one point I was concerned, what will people think about this title? Because the book is Radical Personalism, and we talk about radical communication and radical community, radical guidance, radical this, radical that, and radical means to the root. So one part was called radical sexuality, right? And I thought, I hope they don't misread me and they take the time to read the section and get what I'm trying to propose there. So yeah, it's important. And because it's important, we'll invite you to the breakthrough rooms one more time so you can continue nourishing each other with your reflections, experience, inspirations about this. So we in groups together, we can continue to heal, we can continue to normalize, we can continue to give each other permission to talk about whatever needs to be talked from a healthy place, from a safe space, hopefully. And see you back in a few minutes. Welcome back, you all. And I hope you had a interesting meeting, sharing with intimacy, creativity, connectivity, all these essential qualities. Okay, we have two more raised hands that we will try to honor properly today. Swetadeep Radhika from Ireland and Tato Darshini from Germany. So we'll begin with Swetadeep Radhika. You can unmute yourself, please.
Maharaj,
Pranam.
I really appreciate you just answering to Sam's question. And I was thinking that, it's not so common how, to hear this topic being discussed and you just like discussing it so comfortably. I think that helps us all to become comfortable with the idea that God himself has a sex life. So yeah, I really appreciate. Thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. And of course, I just mentioned that fact, God has a sex life as a statement, but there's so much more to say in that direction. We haven't explored that direction too much because, again, we need first to explore how we are dealing with that principle here. And the more that's properly integrated, we can relate to that in a healthy way. But yeah, thank you for your appreciation.
Yeah, okay, regarding my question. Yesterday we had a really beautiful discussion with Alberto for our EDL podcast, which is yet to be released, so I won't say much about it. But one of the questions that I was left with is regarding the liberation of like non-humans, like animals, birds, or whatever, like going to the spiritual world. Like we have this example, like a few examples, I think, from Mahaprabhu's Leelas, even where a dog is being like, liberated or like going to the spiritual world. So I was just wondering, like, one idea of what I knew of previously is that all like non-human, like, beings in the spiritual world are in the Shantaras, like. Yeah, the plants, animals, maybe something like that. But I'm not too sure about that because, like Lord Brahma, not Lord, yeah, maybe Lord Brahma once is a mountain in Vrindavan or something like that. And then Uddhav also like wants to be grass. So, yeah, I'm not too sure about like the Shantaras bit of it. But what I was wondering is then how, like dog is not doing any sadhana or anything. Like maybe there is a case that in the previous life the dog was something, but just curious, how all of this works and the liberation or how the animals, plants could go to the spiritual world without taking a human birth when the human birth is being, emphasized so much and considered to be higher.
Do you want to know if your cats over there will go to spiritual world this life?
I knew you would say
Confess, confess the question behind the question.
that. No. I knew you would say this, but that wasn't the idea.
It's fine. I'm just joking. Thank you. Thank you for the question. So, of course, there's the rule, there's the exception to the rule, and generally we try not to make the exception the rule because many times it doesn't work like that. So in general, the rule, so to say, is that yeah, you attain the spiritual world, if we want to use that terminology, as in a human vehicle. Why? Again, it's not that it's not that the it's not possible otherwise, because you yourself shared a few examples from our tradition to that effect. So we are not saying it's not possible. In fact, there are statements in the Bhagavatam about the universality of bhakti, not only in terms of species, but in terms of age, right? You can be a boy, Prahlad, Dhruva, in terms of species, Gajendra, the dog in Gaur Lila, and so on and so forth, in terms of varna, ashram, gender. I mean, different examples throughout the scripture of different people, or not even people, attaining perfection in bhakti, like showcasing the universality of bhakti as a general principle. But now, in its practical application, again, we have to put in bear in mind that bhakti, it's a voluntary choice, right? It's an expression of our will in connection to Bhagavan. It's an intentional turning our awareness toward Bhagavan, sammukhyata, in the words of Srila Jiva Goswami. Now, a full turning of our face back to Godhead. Instead of giving our back to Godhead, turning back to Godhead and looking, no? Giving, investing all our faculties voluntarily for his pleasure. So, my point with this is that the human form of life, the human vehicle, the human, especially in our tradition, that we ultimately are dealing with something called Narlila, of human lila. So in the human form, we have this faculty where consciousness becomes aware of itself. Let's put it that way. Like, we can be conscious that we are conscious. Generally, you don't find that in other species. No, you don't find self-awareness. As much as we know, as much as it has been explored, as much as we can see how other species behave in the animal, mineral kingdom. Of course, there are degrees also. I'm not saying that it's just black and white. You can see different degrees, I don't know, of conscious expression in animals like dolphins and so on in comparison to other species. But to the point of Atato Brahma Jignasa, which the Vedanta Sutra says, no? Vedanta Sutra start with Atato Brahma Jignasa. Now it's time to inquire Jignasa into Brahman, into the Absolute. And the Atato, which means now, has been interpreted in many ways. And one of the meanings is now that you can actually read these words, we say Atato Brahma Jignasa, which means you are in a human form of life, basically. So now that you are in this particular experience, called human experience, human vehicle, human consciousness, human form of life, this can facilitate, in its ideal expression, this can take you to, or this is, this exists with the purpose of Brahma Jignasa, deep investigation, deep exploration of Brahman. Brahman means, as we remember, that which expands and makes others expand, that which grows and makes others grow. That's the meaning of Brahman. So that's the purpose, the intention behind human form. That doesn't mean that because you are born in a human body, you are there, right? Let's make the difference there, right? Having the vehicle doesn't warrant that you won the race, so to say, that you are using the vehicle to even be on a race. You can just receive a car and become a serial killer with the car. Instead of reaching a healthy destination without killing anyone on the way. So having a human body doesn't mean that we are being human. Let's put it that way. That's why we always say, be human. Please be human. Generally, you won't say, but I'm already human. Look at this body. You understand that be human means embrace certain qualities that make the word human meaningful. Be kind, be empathic, be compassionate, be sensitive, be human, and so on and so forth. So yeah, again, as a general principle, practice universal. Everyone can attain perfection in principle. But again, in practical terms, we see that most of the people who embrace bhakti consciously and practice it consciously are in a human form of life. That doesn't mean that other souls in different bodies are not benefited. And again, as you say, there may be souls who practice bhakti in previous life. For whatever reason, they are inhabiting a non-human form now. And we don't know, and we cannot put a label on anyone, on this plant, on that tree, on this dog, on this cow. They are going there, they are not going there. We don't have a clue about the trajectory of any soul, including ours, probably. So better we do not become judgmental about, oh, you need to be born as a human, or you need to be born in India, or you need to be born as a Brahmin. I mean, we can create so many layers of upadhi, right? Of impositions, superficial imposition. We don't know. We don't know. So, and that's humbling, and that's inviting us to coexist with not knowing, right? I'm walking, especially as I don't know, I'm hearing Radha Kunda, and we always hear the thing, okay, whomever is born in a place like this, they are not ordinary beings. They look like monkeys and dogs and cows, trees. So you are wondering, okay, who are you, right? I cannot put a label on you, thinking, oh, you're still a tree. You need to be born as me in a human body in Argentina before. No. So that on one side, I will say. As for what you mentioned in terms of Shantarasa and species being Shantarasa, though that may not be the main question, it's not that much like that, actually. For example, cows are said to be in Vatsalya Rasa with Krishna, right? Cows see Krishna with motherly affection. So they are literally described in Vatsalya Rasa. It's a unique expression of Vatsalya Rasa. It's a non-human Vatsalya Rasa in the Lila, but it's not described as Shantarasa. Sometimes they say when the grass in Vrindavan experiences the touch of Krishna's feet, it experiences conjugal love. So you hear these type of things. When Uddhava is praying to be born as even a blade of grass, or Brahma himself prays similarly, it's not so much that they literally want to be a blade of grass. It's more like an expression of humility. You have to understand those verses in context, right? That verse, Asamaho Charanari Inujusam, the verse you are referring to, Uddhava's prayer, it comes after he goes to Vrindavan thinking, I'm going to instruct the Brajavasis so they don't suffer in separation from Krishna. I will give them gyan of Krishna's God as he's omnipresent. He's the absolute. He's everywhere. You need to lament. No need. No, there's no separation, actually. He thought that was his service. And when he's there, he realizes, oh my gosh, I'm sent him to be in school, to be schooled by them. What they are saying and feeling is beyond my pay grade. I what's this? So then at the end he becomes transformed, and he appears a deep epiphany. And this verse and other six verses are prayers that Uddhava offers before leaving Vrindavan, after being on parikram, probably the first Brajamandal parikram conducted by the Brajavasis, taking Uddhava to different places. So Krishna performed this lila here, this lila here. So he is so overwhelmed by the mood of the Brajavasis, and what he thought these Brajavasis were. And now he's rediscovering Krishna, right? Because he lives with Krishna outside of Vrindavan in Dwarka, and he's his personal secretary, and he thought he knew Krishna probably better than anyone. And now he's going to Vrindavan, and he's realizing not only these people here know Krishna way better than I, but they are now helping me to better know Krishna, that I'm going back to Dwarka. Now I can know him even better by the grace of them. So in all that context, overwhelmed by the insights, the epiphanies, the grace he feels he's receiving from the Brajavasis, he's saying, ah, even if I'm born as a blade of grass here, this will be my greatest fortune. But that does mean literally that he wants the rasa of a blade of grass, because he's already has his established relationship with Krishna. He's an eternal associate of Krishna. So he has Sthayi Bhav. Sthayi Bhav means fixed emotional disposition toward Krishna. It's not that you want to change that. Whatever key relationship he has, he's been nourished now by the association with the Brajavasis. But in an example of humility, he's praying that way. Just clarification regarding that prayer. So when it is said that all the non-human species in Vrindavan are in Santa Rasa, it's more in way of saying Santa Rasa is a complex topic. It's a way of saying many of them are externally passive, not because many is relatively passive in comparison to human dynamics, like a tree, like an animal. They may not speak like humans speak. A tree may not move like humans move. Of course, you hear the description on the Leela, and everything is moving, everything is dancing, everything is singing in its own way. But it's a little bit more connection to that they may all put in the Santa Rasa box. Because if you study Santa Rasa in Bhakti Rasamrita Rupa Goswami primarily describes Santa Rasa as the domain of the yogis and the rishis and the contemplatives more connected to impersonal traditions, who are not so much engaged in active service to Bhagavan. While if we speak about all the objects in Vrindavan, entities, whether animate or quote unquote inanimate, they're all pretty animated there with a very favorable, loving disposition. So Santa Rasa is a little bit different. And they will say Santa Rasa, one of the main qualities is nirmamata, which means it is utterly devoid of possessiveness. So of a sense of I, me, mine in connection to Krishna. And I wouldn't say that the cows are devoid of mamata or possessiveness to Krishna. They are quite possessed of a particular sense of relationship, and such so is every other ingredient in the dham. When we hear Vrindavan Mahimamrita and other detailed descriptions of the dham, everything is in a relationship with Bhagavan in a very active way. So I'm very specific. So yeah. But going back to your question again, it can happen. It can happen. Animals, other species being liberated. But in general, the general principle is human form is designed for the inquiry of the absolute. Because again, you don't generally attain salvation or liberation or the spiritual world like by coincidence or casually. It's a very intentional cultivation. That takes time. So it has to be intentional. You have to be aware of what you are doing and the object of your worship and how you are doing and all those types of how to say levels flourishing of blooming levels of flourishing of consciousness mostly happen in the human form of life. In other forms of life on this realm, I'm not talking about Golok. Mineral realm, vegetal realm, animal realm. Of course, the soul, the Atman is there, consciousness is there, but is quite conditioned by the particularities of that species. So the consciousness is not expressing itself in its full blooming. And again, in human life, many cases it doesn't happen either. That's my point. In all other species, every species what it is, and naturally. That's also the price of being the human form of life. If you are a tree doesn't struggle to be a tree. A tree is a tree. And like Thomas Merton say, and by the tree being a tree in itself, it's giving glory to God. Right? And the dog is a dog, right? The dog is not having an existential crisis. Am I a dog? Am I a dolphin? Am I a giraffe? Am I a human being? That's not happening. And they don't have a problem being a dog. They're not fitting in, creating all. They are who they are. We humans, by having a broader potential for conscious expansion, can misuse that in a way that we have lots of dysfunctionalities in terms of being who we are. And that happens, right? That's the price and risk of freedom, so to say. You are given a greater freedom, but that entails a greater freedom to go toward darkness and not only to go toward light. So it's a gift. I give you more freedom. Oh, it's a gift, but you can basically ruin your life with the misuse of that gift, which is not the intention originally of the gift itself, but it can happen. It's what it is. It's the risk of love, as we will talk in other times. Okay, God is love. Love is voluntary. You are given free will because God loves you, and that in itself, coming all that out of love, entails a risk, which is you misuse your free will and you create so much suffering for yourself and others. What to do? It's what it is. No, we cannot just question why I was created in that way, why I was not given, why I was not made perfect, so I could never make a wrong choice. That doesn't make any sense, because if that will happen, you have no free will then. Right? And you are not created to begin with, which is another conversation we talked many times. It's not that you were created in a certain way. We are eternally. So at the end of the day, all the best for our brother, sister, sun, brother, sister, moon, animal, vegetable, cat, mineral kingdom. But yeah, at the end of the day, we have to be quite focused with our own case, which means I'm in a human body. How much of a human I am, right? Because cats are being cats, dogs are being dogs, trees are being trees. They are great, doing great. Am I being human? How much of that? It's not black and white. How much more human can I become? And in the context of full humanity, how to embrace divinity and integrate both together. So, yeah, exciting project. And to explore the limits of our humanity in the sense that the limits, in one sense, there are no limits how human you can become. If we equate human with compassionate, kind, loving, empathic, forgiving, there's no limit to how much you can become all those things. So in one sense, there's no limit to how much human you can become. And in that sense, you can argue the Krishna Lila is fully human and fully divine, but in its ever evolvingness, it becomes every time more human and every moment more divine. It's not that they have reached a rooftop, fully human, fully divine, fully. No possibility of more of that. No, it continues to expand. So going back to our daily situation, we can ask the same question. How can I become more human? In a sustainable way, again, small steps, but increase my humanity a little bit today. Increase my divinity a little bit today. My awareness of my divine status, my properly honoring of my human vessel. What can I do today for my humanity and for humanity? Again, what can I do for humanity? Maybe the next question is, it will be replied in terms of what can I do for my humanity? What can I do for humanity? Maybe become a little bit more human yourself. That's a good beginning point. I'm not saying that's the end of it all, but it's a good beginning point, I will say. Okay. Thank you. I hope that helps. I don't know. What do you think, Sweta? Any further reflections? You mentioned Alberto, but I don't have a clue what was the connection between that and Alberto. You don't want to give us any trailer of that conversation, it seems.
We talked about like animals, non-human beings. I mean, somehow the conversation went in that direction, but it was really beautiful conversation. And whatever you shared now is so helpful. And I was thinking how when I'm asking question, I like really don't ask all that I want to ask, but somehow whatever you share just feels like, oh, that's all I like, you know, I needed to know, you know. So thank you for that. And yeah, the main thing for me, the highlight here is to like question that what it means to be a human and understanding, because I was comparing that, like, you know, yeah, with dogs, cats, with less freedom, they have more capacity to love sometimes than humans do. But yeah, like to question, you know, how can I be more human, what it means, and like, you know, exploring the limits. So yeah, thank you for that.
Never underestimate our potential, right? Before going to, I will skip breakthrough rooms here so we don't become so late, and I will go to Tattva Darshan in one moment. But I'm seeing one brief question related to that. I will reply briefly by Bishaka. She asks, What about Madhavendra Puri? He was a tree in the spiritual world and he came to preach or introduce Madhurya Rasa, if I understood properly. Well, it is described in Gaura Ganodesha Deepika that Madhavendra Puri is described as a Kalpa Vriksha tree in Vrindavan, a desire tree. But to be honest, I'm not so inclined to take that literally. No? Because many times we will say, okay, you are a Kalpa Vriksha tree. The Vaishnavas are Bancha Kalpa Taruvyascha. Immediately you have there. No? Vaishnavas are desire tree. That means that literally you are a tree. Not necessarily. So I wouldn't necessarily go to the point that he was. I mean, I'm not saying it's not possible at all he can be a tree, but I wouldn't take that particular depiction in an absolute literal way that he was a tree. But even if he was a tree, yeah, what's the problem again? We can again make a connection between a tree from Golok Vrindavan can do so much over here. And we can see that in example of Madhavendra Puri if we want to take that. And John is mentioning, yes, we want to become like the grass, like the trees, according to Mahaprabhu. So many times this prayer, so let me be grass. Grass is very symbolic in our tradition of humility. Again, Mahaprabhu says, Trinadapi Sunichena. So again, not necessarily means you want to take that particular shape, but the grass is something that is below, right? So that below, from that quote unquote insignificant place, which is not insignificant at all, you are invaded by humility and you don't dare to claim any position and they say, let me be grass. But you may have your own particular longing for a specific relationship with Krishna, as Uddhava already had. So yeah, claiming I want to be grass, I want to be a speck of dust. Mahaprabhu is saying that, right? Aji nanda tanuya kinkaram patitamman bishame babambudo kripaya tava pada pankaya shtita dhuli sadrisham bichintaya. Fifth verse of Shikshastakam. He's praying, I want to, it speaks in terms of dust, of foot dust. But it's not that Mahaprabhu wants literally to become that. I mean, Mahaprabhu is Krishna pursuing Radha Bhav. So he has a very specific project in mind. But invaded by a certain type of humility, one may say that. And also to highlight the point that even a literal speck of that dust there is not ordinary. Vaikunthera prithivi adi sakala chinmay, say. From Vaikuntha upwards, even a speck of dust is absolute transcendental substance, so it's worthy of our veneration, Srila Siddha Maharaj will say. That's the land of gurus where even the dust is our guru. So he will say, if everything, every atom there is totally conscious and venerable, we cannot walk with our feet there because we cannot trample onto our gurus. So we will walk with our head down, offering pranam to everything on our way. It's a way of putting it. Now, we never see pictures of the eternal Brajavasis walking like this, but you can just take a picture and turn it the other way around, and you have all of them offering pranam to everything on their path. So. Okay, Tato Darshini, whatever you may like to share with us today, more than welcome.
Krishna. I mean, actually, I thought my question can be easily postponed for next Saturday, so I would give my part to John. If you have a.
We have some time.
Okay. The last 2 weeks, I was quite churning, reading the Gopi Gita, and actually, I have also a picture. And in our little sangha, which occurred after your Gokadam visit, we spoke last time about because
Sorry.
since
If when you are moving, we cannot hear you properly.
Since years I have these pictures, some may know from Aindra Prabhu,
Yes.
and
That changes. You move it, then it's Radha Krishna Lila and Gaur Lila.
yeah, and since I have it, I'm always wondering. I mean, there are eight gopis, like it should be. Radharani is the most exalted gopi, but there's one gopi here. She is blue. And I was wondering, or we were wondering, why is this gopi blue? I mean, we had some explanation, But then it's not clear for me. Then it should be like nine gopis. So I don't know. Of course, you didn't paint this picture. We cannot ask Indra anymore. So maybe you have an idea about this blue gopi
I
or
have
not.
no idea.
Okay, I mean
Oh,
there's.
of course there are many. I'm trying to see the picture properly.
It's a little difficult with the lights.
I'm trying to look for the picture here myself. So you are referring to you are referring to the aspect of the book where there's Radha, where Radha is singing with the gopis, right?
Yeah, because this is the part where the gopis are sitting at the river Yamuna.
I thought I thought it was the other part when you move and it's Mahaprabhu with his associates. So yes, something I can say, but it still is my speculation in the sense that I haven't received any confirmation from the author. I've read the book years ago, but I don't remember if there's anything mentioned in the books, if you know. But for me, it made me think that it's Krishna actually dressed as a gopi, because there are many leelas in which Krishna himself dressed as a gopi, and he has different.
Is in the tree up.
Sorry?
Krishna is in the tree up. Isn't it? There's
I
a tree.
see. Okay, I'm seeing it now. Okay.
Sorry.
So that makes even more interesting. Yeah.
So he's watching, and both
Yeah, because
Krishna
that's kind of
and both
the
have
typical, yeah, that's kind of the typical image of the Gopi Gita, right? Radha leading the singing, and the gopis accompanying her, and Krishna on top in this painting, or sometimes depicted as behind the tamal tree, camouflage in the tamal tree because it's a similar color than his own hue. But yeah, we never hear in this particular case on top of that of the blue gopi joining there. So I'm sure some of Indra's close associates may know. Maybe there is some confidential element there. I don't want to, again, speculate publicly about things like, okay, maybe it's Indra producing his own Siddha Swarup included in the cover. I don't know. I don't know. I'm sure there is some reason for that, because it naturally takes one's attention. But if it's in the book, I've read it, but I don't remember. So sorry for that. And if it's not in the book, then we need to do some research and ask about it.
Okay.
Because generally, when we hear about sapphire blue like gopi, which has a very similar complexion to that of Krishna's, like we are seeing here in the cover, generally it's Krishna himself being dressed as a gopi with the purpose of entering into the inner circle of Radha and the Manjaris, and many times after Radha got manini, which means she got into man or loving pique, loving anger, and Krishna needs to appease her and beg her forgiveness, so he will appear as a gopi and will render her service, and so on and so forth. But in this case, yeah, we will need to leave today's meeting on a note of mystery.
Sorry.
That's interesting.
One other answer we got from somebody who knows Indra Prabhu quite well. He said that this is actually Lord Shiva. I also was thinking all the time about Krishna because of the blue. But he said, no, it is Lord Shiva. He also wanted to be part of the Rasa dance. And so he also joined, and that Krishna gave him therefore the name Gopeshwar.
Well,
But
but generally what we hear about Gopeshwar Mahadev is that Gopeshwar remains at the gate of Vrindavan, taking care that nobody unqualified enters there. And there are different stories to that effect, that Mahadev witnessed the Rasa Lila, and he wanted to participate, and then but he knew, okay, you have to be a gopi, and he kind of there are different versions of the story. One of them is that he dresses a gopi and tries to be infiltrated. And then the gopis start to ask him, okay, so what's your name, and which village are you coming from? And all this village questioning. And Mahadev didn't know what to say. So he was discovered and taken out. And another one is that he tried to join the Rasa Lila as Shiva, with his guru Sankarshan around his neck, which is a snake. And it was not very practical for all practical purposes to engage in Rasa Lila from that way. So Krishna somehow put him at the position of a gatekeeper. And that's why there are these famous prayer, Vrindavanavani Patit Jaya Soma Suma Mola Sanaka Sanatan Sanandan Naradidya Gopishwar Braja Vilasi Jugangi Padme Prem Prayachani Rupade Namo Namaste. Which basically one prays to Lord Shiva as the gatekeeper of Braj, and in different parts of Braj there are different Shiva lingams that somehow are there for us to pray to gain proper entrance into the dam. Here in Radhakund they have in different places you have in Vrindavan you have Gopeshwar Mahadev. He's one of the most ancient temples in Vrindavan, and the I had. I was trained to go there first. That was always the very first place we will go in Vrindavan as to pray to Gopesh Mahadev to actually enter Vrindavan, because you were of course you were already in Vrindavan physically, but that doesn't mean entering Vrindavan. So to pray to him, Prem Prayacha Nirupadi, make me Nirupadi, make me free from upadis, from false designations, limiting adjuncts that filter my vision. So here in Radhakund we have Kundeshwar Mahadev. Right, so there are different names for Mahadev, which end up with Ishwar, Gopishwar, Kundeshwar, and so on, Chakaleshwar. And they're like again in the post of gatekeepers, protecting the entry gate, so to say. And this Kundeshwar is right at the beginning of the parikram to Radhakund, to the circumambulation. So, but I will be interested also if they have that version. What's the story of the evidence supporting that. I have some friends who are close to Ayendra Prabhu, so I also may ask them. So yeah, thank you for bringing the point here. It's nice to remain in some state of uncertainty, healthy.
I have to sit here and work, and I hope one day I will have an idea what it is about.
Yeah, and even if we never get to actually know who is that blue gopi, it's okay also, right? I mean, it's good to make our best effort, and then it's good to know when to be okay with not knowing, which is in itself a good lesson. Not be lazy, no, like Krishna Das Kavya Goswami saying Chaitanya Charitamrita, na siddhanta valiya chitta na akara ala sihahaiti Krishna lage sudrida manas. Try to learn Siddhanta, try to learn the proper conclusions or to proper way of thinking about the divine. Nakaralas, don't be lazy, he says. Because he knows we may be lazy. But that doesn't mean try to understand. In the name of not being lazy, you become addicted to absolute certainty. No, we also learn, we need to learn to know when to let go and accept. I don't know. So. All that to say, I don't know. Okay, we have a few more minutes. I mean, I feel like we have a few more minutes in case someone has something else. If not, we can put this sharing to rest. But if case some of you have not raised your hand, would like to present anything today. One more thing, it may be a question, a sharing, something you would like to contribute to the conversation. We have Manjali raising her hand from Glastonbury. So please welcome Manjali, unmute yourself.
Okay, I'm unmuted. Today in England, or maybe tomorrow in Indian calendar, I'm not sure, is Gaurakishore Das Babaji, or Gaurakishore Das Babaji's Trayavov, or Disappearance Day. And I just wanted to know if you could say just a few words about him. He, of course, the spiritual master of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta and friend of Bhakti Vinod Thakur. So, could you just give us a few little sound bites to take away that would help us to remember one of our gurus in our line?
Okay. Why not? Srila Gaurakishore Das Babaji Maharaj Ki Jai. Yeah, tomorrow At least here in India as well, it's Ekadashi, is the disappearance day of Sri Gaur Kishore Das Babaji, the appearance day of Bhaktidayita Madhav Maharaj, and beginning of Bhishma Panchak, and a few other things. So, Gaur Kishore Das Babaji Maharaj, of course, there's not that much known about him in comparison to what we know about personalities like Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Sridhar Maharaj, and so on. Even Bhaktivinoda Thakur, because Srila Gaur Kishore Das Babaji was an avadhut. He was not a, how to say, a public person with like usual social dynamics. So generally it's difficult to write a full memoir of such person because you don't know where they will be tomorrow, what they will do, how to So to begin with, I like to say, okay, he's Gaur Kishore Das Babaji. So he's a Babaji and he's in our line. So we have no problem with Babajis, okay? Babaji is not a bad word. Because for some reason, unfortunately, especially in the line coming from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, sometimes there has been in some, or there is in the mind of many, this bad flavor with, oh, the Babajis, like in a derogatory way. Oh, those are Babajis, and Babajis implying for some sahaja, or for some imitationist, or that's not our line. But if we see our parampara, Gaur Kishore Das Babaji, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he was a Babaji at the end of his life, Jagannath Das Babaji, and if you continue, there will be many other. I mean, everyone else, if they are at least renunciant, there will be Babajis because sannyas was something that somehow was implemented by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And again, that's a whole other conversation, sannyas, Babaji. At the end of the day, both are equally okay, in my opinion, and both are equally valid, and it's just different ways of approaching the life of renunciation and dedication in that context. But he was a Babaji, and we worship him, okay? And there are many other worshipable Babajis in contemporary times. It's not just, okay, the only bona fide ones were the old ones who no longer exist. Now only the sannyasis are the bona fide renunciants. Many times that's not the case at all, right? And also Babaji doesn't necessarily mean someone, because I see the John mentions a recluse, but not necessarily. A Babaji can, it was just the way of conceiving renunciation in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And some Babajis were more traveling, giving speakers, talks and lectures. Some others were, I mean, like the Goswamis were Babajis. And they were writing books, opening temples, living with the local government. They were not just inside a cave, so to say. Because sometimes we get this idea, okay, Babajis are all avadhut, all recluse, not necessarily. And sannyasis, we think, all traveling, all preachers, not necessarily. Some of them may be quite recluse. So each case is unique. So Gaur Kishore Das Babaji, okay, so he was an avadhut, again, and we don't have extreme time, so to say, to go into the details. But he was avadhut, which means someone who basically does not live his life, who is outside of the box. Let's begin there. Who lives his life outside, who cannot be restrained by the normal codes of society that most people need to be crafted as a proper functional human. And again, most of us need that, but someone like Gaur Kishore Das Babaji, and it's not only Gaur Kishore Das Babaji, we find that in other traditions, people who are on another level altogether, and who are basically, who will be seen on a clinical eye of society as madmen. They are crazy. Of course, it's divine madness, which in itself is another conversation because we want to become mad, ultimately. The goal of life is madness, divine madness. Free will is basically that, to choose which type of madness you want. Because if you don't choose divine madness, you will go crazy in one and some other direction, that's for sure. So free will means pick your madness. So Gaur Kishore Das Babaji picked, and he picked well. So he was, again, he was very, how to say, Very exemplary in the ways of he was not interested in any followers, in having disciples. He was very much absorbing his own practice. He was sure here and there a little bit, but he was also very much going straight to the point when something went, and he had this very mystical, subtle perception when someone was not taking the real thing seriously. Like someone, for example, I don't know, a few famous stories from him, let's share. He will be living in his cottage, and sometimes he will live in a cottage. Someday he will be found sleeping under a boat which was turned upwards, and he was sleeping there. Sometimes to avoid gaining fame and prestige, he will stay at houses of people of ill repute, just so people will speak nonsense and gossip about him, and they wouldn't bother him in his budget. Now imagine, no, imagine. Some of us are mad after praise and prestige and showing who we are not, so we can gain some reputation out of that. And he was on the other extreme. So once he was in his cottage and he had his life, his way of living, his way of doing his bhajan, and at some point someone started to live nearby him and built a similar cottage and start kind of to imitate Gorky Shordas Babaji. Because again, as much as he tried to escape reputation, Gorky Shordas Babaji was known as a Siddha Mahatma or as a perfected being. So some people were attracted to him, and some of them start to imitate him. That's what happens with great personalities. Some are genuinely attracted to them for the right reasons, and they want to follow their footsteps and serve them. And some others just want to be near them, so they somehow inherit the reputation of the person who is nearby me, something, and they start to imitate externally. So after some time, Gorky Shordas Babaji say. He will say something like he would even mention the name of the person and address a particular case. He was just out of the blue say, "Well, if a young girl, if a female adult is pregnant, she will give birth to a child. But if a young girl of 5 years sees that and starts to imitate the pains of birthing and puts a balloon on her belly." No, that doesn't mean that a baby's coming, right? So he will say that out of context without giving any clarification cryptically. But if you get the point he was making, that he was speaking in relation to that particular person, right? Like it's just imitating the externals is not creating the birth of the child of love, so to say. If there is no the actual inner impregnation and inner process that takes you there, right? Or this other famous story that probably most of you know, but it's always nice to remember. Once again, he was very disinterested in in social gatherings and getting followers, and especially very not disinterested with somehow someone was announced as a very famous big personality, and especially because of being very charismatic and having lots of knowledge, he will raise his eyebrows when all that stuff will come to him, right? And one came to him, someone, and they say, "Yeah, there's this great speaker of the Bhagavatam who is coming to our town. So please, if you want to listen from him, no, you can. It will be very special, and he knows about them by heart, and he sings it in so many tunes. This that." So anyhow, he went with someone else. So he was the whole recitation there, and then after the recitation is over, someone asked him like, "So how was the recitation? Which are your thoughts?" And everyone was expecting he will praise the reciter because it was so much charisma and so much knowledge, and even some tears coming from the speaker. But tears can come for many reasons, right? So Gorky Shordas Babaji say, "Please immediately clean this whole room with cow dung." And everyone was like, "Why? What?" Because cow dung, you use it to purify something. So why you are telling that we should purify this room? It has been totally purified by the recitation of the Bhagavatam. Which higher purification could there be? And he say, "You heard the Bhagavatam. I only heard rupee, 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 he said. Money, money, money. Right? So he made that point, right? Like, yeah, out in externally the Bhagavatam was being recited, but the motivation for that person, he was a professional reciter of the Bhagavatam. So he was not reciting Bhagavatam as a service to the Bhagavatam, Bhagavat Seva. He was doing as a work, as a job. His life was not aligned with the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam was a profession he took to earn money to live a life that was separate from the ideal of the Bhagavatam. Right? So that's why Gorgeous Bhagavad say, I never heard the Bhagavatam. Again, the Bhagavatam is not just the words, the verses, it's the lifestyle behind the recitation. And that's why on the other side, on the contrary, sometimes they say, you should never charge for speaking the Bhagavatam. But actually, the spirit of that is don't make a business out of a sacred text. But if for whatever reason someone is charging, but that money is used for a lifestyle that is aligned with the principles of the Bhagavatam, by you having people giving their money for that, they are getting purified by investing their money in that project. Again, not to justify the unjustifiable, but there is a place for that. There's a place for engaging people's energy assets in the service of the Bhagavatam. And there's the opposite. No? So anyhow, a few stories about Gaurakishore Das Babaji. As you say, Manjali, he was the guru of Srila Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, his only disciple, basically. He was not interested in disciples, and even when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur went to ask for that on this instruction of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Gaurakishore Das Babaji did not accept him immediately. No, it took time. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had to insist many times. It's very much similar to the story of Narottam Das Thakur and Lokanath Goswami. You know, when it's another conversation, but Narottam Das Thakur will go, and Lokanath Goswami had made a vow, I will never accept any disciples. He made a vow, I will not accept disciples. And Narottam Das Thakur met him and fell in love with him and started to serve him. And Lokanath Goswami said, don't serve me. I don't want to be served by anyone. I want to serve everyone. That was his particular mode in a healthy way. And Narottam Das Thakur was like, okay, I cannot serve him directly. I will serve him indirectly, secretly. So every day, Lokanath Goswami will go to bathe himself in a river and then pass tool nearby. So when he will leave, Narottam Das will go and clean the area, brush it, clean it every day. So after some time, Lokanath Goswami is like, what's going on? Every time I come here to pass tool, everything is clean, there are flowers, there's incense put. I suspect someone is serving me secretly. So next day he goes, does that, and then he pretends he's leaving, but he hides behind a bush. And after a few minutes, he sees Narottam Das Thakur coming and cleaning and happily serving his guru. Right? In his heart, he accepted him as his guru, even if it was not officially consummated. And then Lokanath Goswami jumps, say, what are you doing? And Narottam Das Thakur is, and he said, I told you, I made a vow, I don't want disciples. And Narottam Das Thakur recites a poetry that says, if a young girl in the village fell in love with a boy, but her family made arrangement for her to marry with someone else, she will never be happy by that arrangement. So Narottam Das Thakur, who was a very beautiful singer and poet, sings that to him, like implying, I already chose you. So Lokanath Goswami leaves not knowing what to do, and he then presents, and I'm going off topic, but it's all connected. And then he presents that his dilemma. He was in a dilemma because all this lasted for. After that, actually, after that, what happened is that Lokanath Goswami gave Narottam Das Thakur permission to continue doing that daily service of cleaning. Okay, you continue doing it. And that continued with one for 1 year, but they didn't have personal interaction. It was just Narottam Das Thakur cleaning the stool of his guru on a daily basis. And he felt so fulfilled by that. No? And after a whole year, Lokanath Goswami is in the dilemma because there is this person, Narottam Das, who is serving me with so much dedication and love and enthusiasm, and I made this vow of never accepting any disciples. So he's consulting a senior, a friend, but also senior Bhugarbha Goswami, famous for living on the, under the earth. Bhugarbha, his womb was the Bhumi, the earth. And he tells, I'm in this dilemma with this young boy Narottam. I made this vow of not accepting disciples. And Bhugarbha Goswami replies, yes, it's possible that you made a vow that not to accept him, not to accept any disciples, but it seems that he made a vow to accept you as his guru. And it seems that his vow is more powerful than yours. Right? So after hearing that, Lokanath Goswami realized, yes. So he calls Narottam Das Thakur, imagine, calls him and said, I've made a vow to never accept disciples, but to have a disciple like you will be my honor and my purification and my good fortune. So I break my vow to honor a higher vow. No? And then he becomes his only initiated disciple, right? So in a similar way, Gaur Kishore, and then Narottam Das Thakur had thousands of disciples, interestingly. So very similarly, Gaur Kishore Das Babaji only have one disciple, and then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had thousands of disciples. And somehow we are all here because of them, right? Because of this sacred change of masters, then of course Srila Prabhupada, Srila Maharaj, and so on. Is that somehow we are here today having the chance of saying some words about them. So thank you for the invitation, Manjali, Sri Gaur Kishore Das Babaji Maharaj Ki Jai. There is so much more to say, but I don't want to take much more of your time. But I would like to invite you for a few more minutes before we put the conversation to rest, to one more final breakthrough room. A few minutes, share whatever is in your heart that you may like to share with your kindred spirits in the room, and see you in a few minutes before we conclude today's satsang. Okay, welcome back, you all, and all shiny, smiley, nourished. So I'm happy that you are able to share within each other the milk, the nourished milk of Harikatha, the intoxicating wine of your blissful association. Thank you for blessing each one of us with your presence, each one of you, your unique contribution, and very glad that Wi-Fi worked today and we were able to make it through. And looking forward to seeing you next Saturday. I will be in Navadvip by that time, streaming directly from Sri Chaitanya Saraswat Math, Srila Sridhar Maharaj's place. So making the arrangements to get Wi-Fi there. Let's see. Let's pray for it. And see you soon. Keep in touch. Thank you so much, Sri Sachinandan Gaur Hari Ki Jai, Harinam Prabhu Ki Jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Bol, Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha, Kripa Sindhu Vyevacha, Atitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah.